An award-winning English writer, Rupert Thompson's 11th novel, Never Anyone But You, is based on a true story about two French women and their love affair in the early 20th century. Shortlisted for the 2018 American Library and Paris Book Award, the novel also reveals the author's preoccupation with trauma and loving someone impossible.
You know, we all lose loved ones and we all lose jobs and, you know, unexpected things happen to all of us. Often quite unusual, unexpected things. And really, my books are just slightly extreme and unexpected examples of something normal, I think, or something universal.
He also discusses writing his memoir, This Party's Got to Stop, winner of the 2010 Writers Guild Award for Best Nonfiction. It details the loss of his mother when he was 8 and his father's death when he and his two brothers were in their 20s. Find out what fuels the imagination of Rupert Thompson today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Rupert Thompson was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2015. On the surface, his 11 novels seem to vary widely, ranging from psychological to historical fictions. While critically acclaimed, this perception is not really welcomed by the author, as you'll hear in this conversation at the Kansas City Public Library.
I have a bit of a problem with the phrase literary fiction. I feel it sounds a little bit elitist, and I feel it puts people off, generally speaking. Literary fiction should just mean good writing. That's all I think it is. It's writers who take real care with the words and with the sentences and with how those sentences are put together. You know, they spend time on that. So as far as every book being different, this is what the critics always say about me. They've been saying this for, you know, decades practically now.
But that's such a wonderful thing. Well, isn't that what makes it literary?
It makes me really difficult to market. And in this world that we're living in now, what readers quite like, it seems to me, is sort of having the same book over and over again in a slightly different form, you know, from the same writer. So they know what they're going to get, and there's a kind of reassurance in that, and there's a continuation in that somehow. Whereas what I appear to be giving the reader is something absolutely different every time. Now, actually, I would take issue with that. I think when the critics say that my books are all completely different, I think that's a superficial reading. Sometimes a journalist will say, so your books are all so different, aren't they? And I'll say, no. And they'll say, oh, really? What do you mean? And I would say, well, when I look back, which I try not to do, I can identify certain preoccupations. And one of those preoccupations seems to be with trauma. In other words, often, right at the beginning of the book, the character has suffered quite an unusual and extraordinary event. It's as if their normal life has been derailed, and they have to start living a new kind of life. And it's almost as if the book is a description of their transformation from one kind of life to another. So when you reach the end of the book, it's like the first day of the rest of their life. They've passed through a kind of convalescence or through a kind of coming to terms with something.
Well, I want to go to your newest novel, Never Anyone But You, because it's a fascinating look at these two women. Actually, why don't you describe it?
It's based on the true story of two remarkable French women. They were born more than a century ago, but in a really uncanny way, they're absolutely relevant right now because they were fighting against the kind of things that I'm hoping most of us are fighting against, which is against kind of an overly patriarchal society. They were fighting against homophobia, they were fighting against fascism, they were fighting against gender stereotyping. All this 100 years ago. You know, they were born in the 1890s and they grew up in a small city in Western France. And there was this amazing moment in 1909, one of them called it a thunderclap moment, where they met. And one of them was 14 and a half only, I think, and the other one was almost 17. And they kind of fell in love. And of course, love between women was unthinkable in the provinces at that time. Probably still is, actually, there. And so the love had to remain a secret. And therefore, they were both under huge pressure. And one of them, Claude Cahun, really suffered from that pressure. I mean, she made a suicide attempt. She became anorexic. And then the most extraordinary thing happened. I mean, you couldn't really make it up, which was that the father of one married the mother of the other. So from being lovers, they then became sisters, which was the perfect alibi. It was almost as if the parents were colluding on their behalf It was almost as if the parents were childlike in their naivety. So then, of course, the two women could be together without anyone thinking it was strange.
Oh, that is the most remarkable thing. Well, would you read the beginning of this?
Okay. I was going to read about how they met.
Okay.
It just gives you the kind of emotional background to the whole thing.
This is told in first person by one of the girls.
I'm writing in the voice of the older and slightly less charismatic of the two women. And the reason was because Claude Cahun, who you could Google, that's C-A-H-U-N, if you Google her, you will come up with a series of photographs, extraordinary photographs, which are taken by the character I'm writing as, so taken by her lover, in which she appears almost unrecognizable from one picture to the next. This is where she's pushing against the boundaries of gender and exploring what a woman can be. And so she'll appear as a kind of effeminate weightlifter, or a Buddha, or a sailor, or a dandy in a suit, or an aviator in goggles and a silk scarf, with a completely shaved head, and this is in 1928. You know, she was doing things that nobody else was doing at the time. But I thought if I wrote as her, since she was so psychologically complicated and damaged, and also because she thought of herself as a writer, I would have to then imitate the various works of her that already exist. Whereas if I wrote as Marcel Moore, it could be like a kind of Great Gatsby idea. It's like Marcel Moore's the Nick Carraway character, and Claude Cahun is the Great Gatsby. So it's like an ordinary person looking at an extraordinary one. And the strange thing about writing as Marcel Moore was that I started off thinking I'm writing as the boring one, and I became more and more interesting as the writing went on, until such a point where I thought, actually, Marcel Moore is just as interesting as Claude, if not more so.
They're both pretty fascinating, yeah. I have to say.
So this is how they met. Our first meeting of any consequence was in the spring of 1909 in Nantes. She was still called Lucy then. She was 14 and a half. Her father, Maurice Schwab, was Jewish, and he owned and edited the biggest newspaper in Western France. Her mother was a Catholic. Madame Schwab was often ill and spent most of her life in clinics. On the morning my mother took me to their apartment, a reason was given for Madame Schwab's absence, but it sounded unconvincing, even to me, only drawing attention to the shame it was intended to conceal. A maid showed us into a parlor cluttered with the ornate, ungainly furniture so favored by bourgeois society at the time. It was still raining. It had rained all night, and the corners of the room lay in deep shadow. The space in which we stood felt rounded and bleary, like a crystal ball that was no longer being used. Lucy had been attending a school in England, my mother told me, but she was back now, and perhaps I could be a friend to her. Outside, trees gleamed black beneath a somber sky. The door opened and Lucy stepped into the room, followed by her father, a solid man with an affable, lined face. Shorter than me and slighter, Lucy seemed removed and ethereal, as if she existed in a different dimension from the rest of us. And yet I felt a jolt as our eyes met, the strong but subtle click of recognition. Words came with it, words that whispered inside my head. Ah, yes, of course. Lucy and I had played together as young children, but I had only the sketchiest memory of that. Some moments are so dazzling that they obliterate everything that came before. This new Lucy had a pale, almost luminous complexion, and her wavy dark brown hair, and on her cheek, halfway between her provocative, determined mouth and the delicate curl of her left ear, was a smear of red that looked like jam. I imagined I could taste that jam and her cheek beneath it, the raspberries picked during the summer and simmered in sugar, the skin creamy and cool. I couldn't remember having such thoughts before, even about boys, and I found myself blushing, but the light in the room was so dim that I don't think anybody noticed. Lucy came forwards and spoke to me in English. "How do you do, Suzanne?" We shook hands. Her father sighed, then turned to my mother. "I'm afraid Lucy has become something of an Anglophile." "Father," Lucy said, "I always was." She let go of my hand, but her eyes, which sloped downwards at the outer edges, remained fixed on mine. What did she see in me? I'm not sure. I was quiet, a little shy. My hair fell past my shoulders and was parted in the middle. There were ink stains on my fingers. There were more than 2 years between us. I was nearly 17, but I was aware of no difference in age. If anything, I felt younger. She had a kind of authority even then, the extended hand, the steady gaze. I'd never met anyone like her. Henri Michaux, who later became a friend of ours, put it best. In his novel, Un Certain Plume, the head waiter places a lamb cutlet in front of the protagonist and, bending close to him, speaks in a voice that is mysterious and deep. That which you have on your plate, he says, does not appear on the menu. The room darkened. Over by the window, my mother was talking to Monsieur Schwab. Beyond them, in the square, the fierce, gravelly crashing of the rain. I was still staring at Lucy. I couldn't take my eyes off her. My mouth was dry and my heart was jumping. Later, Lucy would claim that she had felt the same. She said it was the first great moment of our lives.
That was the beginning of the novel, Never Anyone But You, A Marriage of Convenience, 1909 to 1920. And you're listening to Rupert Thompson here on New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library. It's a good way to begin. Actually, any passage you pick from this novel is a good way to begin. Really, you're such a beautiful writer. I love the way you open your books. There's always something that just grabs you right from the beginning. Do you perceive of the opening at the start, or is it something that you come back and rewrite to begin?
Yeah, the opening often changes quite a lot. Although I've noticed there's something quite strange about working on laptops, you know, as we all do now. I'm not sure what it used to be like, but now, whenever I open the file, because I keep the whole thing on one file, the first thing that appears, obviously, is the first page. So almost every day I tinker with the first page before going to where I'm supposed to be. But it is something I think about a lot. You want to give the reader something intriguing at the front that's going to make them keep reading.
You did an interesting thing in your memoir, This Party's Got to Stop.
With the memoir, for a long, long time, I had this great, I thought, great opening sentence, which was, it was raining softly the night we decided to kill my father. I thought that was fantastic. I thought it was really intriguing. Obviously, we didn't kill him, and you get to understand why we wanted to kill him and why we didn't. So it was like that in the final version, and gave it to my agent, and he said lots of complimentary things, but he said, I do have a bit of a problem with how it begins. Don't you think you're going to alienate the reader right from the word go? And I said, well, isn't it a funny scene? I mean, I think it's a really funny first sentence. But in the end, I suppose his uncertainty about it fed into me, and I became a little bit uncertain about it. And then I realized that actually I'd thought the book was about the death of my father, and it wasn't. It was actually all about the death of my mother, mm-hmm. which had happened 20 years before. So I realized actually the book should begin with her, so now it does. And now I think it has actually a just as good an opening sentence, if not a better one, which is, my mother spoke to me once after she was dead.
Yeah. You'd really jump around in time quite a bit in your memoir, and yet it has this through line in it. But I wondered what made you decide to make it that much of a mosaic pattern?
It happened naturally. It happened out of a sense of frustration because I thought I knew what the book was. I thought it was a description of one summer and coming to terms with the death of my father, and wrote it a couple of times like that. And then I read it and I was really disappointed. It wasn't a book. I mean, it had a good beginning and a good end, but it was kind of slack in the middle, like a badly sprung bed and uncomfortable in that sense. And so I thought, it's not working. And I left it for a bit. And when I went back and looked at it, I saw that I'd cheated at one point because the book was a description of the summer of 1984. And when I looked back at it, I saw that there was a scene from 1986 which was outside the frame of the book and shouldn't have been there. And it was a description of meeting my uncle in the West Midlands. And I looked at it and I suddenly realized that actually is the key to the whole thing. That's what's going to help me write the book. What I need to do is write the whole summer of 84 in the present tense, because that's my present concern. And then have various encounters with other members of my family to try and find out what the family's like and who we are. So those encounters would be, even though they were going to be more recent, they'd be in the past tense, because they were going to be like a gloss or a commentary on the central theme of the book. So it came about in a kind of natural way, that mosaic structure. And the trick then was to try and make it seamless, and that's what took all the work, because, as you
knitting
say...
Knitting it together in
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, because it goes from 1965 up to 2008, and it goes all over the world. It goes from New York to Shanghai, because the book actually twists. I love it when books do this. They twist into a different shape under your hands, almost. You start out thinking they're one thing, and when you've got the finished book, it's not at all what you thought you were going to be doing. And with a memoir, it was a classic example of that, because it turned into a kind of love letter to my long-lost brother, because it just really hit home the size and the degree of that rift. You know, it was 23 years since I'd seen him.
You know, one of the other things that comes up in your works is mental illness, people who suffer from it, because, and never anyone but you, one of the girls, her mother, there's this great scene where they're out for a bicycle ride towards the beginning of the book, and this woman comes out and pushes her down off her bicycle and kind of scares her, and then the family member comes up and takes the older woman, and then when she catches up with her friend on the bicycle, she said, "Why didn't you stop? Why didn't you help me?" And she says, "I thought it was my mother."
Yeah. So, I mean, she means it reminded her of her mother.
Yeah.
It's really traumatic, actually, though, Claude Cahun's childhood, because her mother, it turns out, was a schizophrenic. And there was this episode when Claude was 3 or 4 years old. And much later, when she wrote about this episode, she said, "It remains vivid in my memory," and then doesn't describe what happened. So you have to look elsewhere in the various surviving papers to find out a little bit more, and she does give a few hints, and it seems that her mother had chased her down a corridor in their home and kicked her so she fell over, and then when she saw what she'd done, she kneeled down in front of her daughter and, you know, pleaded forgiveness and cried, and that was almost more terrifying than the being kicked and kicked over. And after that, you know, Madame Schwab, as I hinted at in the piece I read, was removed to clinics, and really Claude didn't see her much after that, and Claude was farmed out to her grandmother, to an aunt, sent to England. And I think a lot of her psychological scarring dates from that.
Again, that trauma that you're talking about. That,
well, if you look at the photographs, and every now and then there's a show, you know, somewhere in the world of Claude Cahun's photographs, and they're tiny, black and white, but they're incredibly powerful. You know, she always has this kind of very defiant or playful gaze in the photographs. She's always looking straight at the camera. But underneath that gaze, you always feel there's this psychological fragility. She can never quite conceal it. And it's almost as if in creating all these different identities, which is what she did through her life, it's to compensate for actually having no identity, you know, because her mother being taken away from her didn't allow her to form herself as a woman properly. And when she did see her mother occasionally, the mother would always criticize her. The mother would say things like, "You're too short," or, "Your nose isn't Greek enough," or, you know, "Your ears stick out, you should wear a bonnet and maybe they'll lie closer to your head." And, you know, so it's little wonder that Claude later on in her writings refers to her badly made body. She had real issues with what we now call self-esteem, I think. You know, you wouldn't have called it that back then. So yeah, she had a lot on her plate psychologically, and Marcel Moore was the rock on which the kind of relationship was built. She held everything together.
Well, I've marked a passage that's very short from Never Anyone But You that will give people an idea of their personalities.
Okay. "On one of our first afternoons alone together, Lucy asked me how I saw my future. I told her my passion was drawing and that I was planning to study at the École des Beaux-Arts. Lucy's ambition was to write. My uncle Marcel was a writer, she told me. I was very close to him. He died 5 years ago. I'm sorry." Her eyes drifted away from me towards the window. The curve of her throat, the slope of her nose, something leapt inside me like a flame. "He was a pervert," she looked at me sidelong. "Sometimes he dressed in women's clothes." I already knew that Lucy liked to shock. The way to impress her, I thought, was to appear not to be impressed. "I'm descended from a poet," I told her. "Really?" "Yes, his name was François de Malherbe." She sat back. Never heard of him. Well, I'd never heard of your uncle either, I said. Not until just now. That's hard to believe. Why? He was friends with Oscar Wilde and Colette, she said. He even wrote a play for Sarah Bernhardt. Well, I've heard of them. Lucy looked at me, eyes glittering. You're very funny. No one had ever told me I was funny before. It's difficult to convey quite how intoxicating that was.
I love that because it's the moment that the spark began. That was from Never Anyone But You by Rupert Thompson here on New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library.
When I was researching the book, I went to Jersey, which is where they lived. Jersey is this island off the northwest coast of France, one of the Channel Islands. And I heard about this housekeeper called Lucille, who was housekeeper in the last 2 years of Claude's life, 1952 to 54. And then after Claude's death, carried on being Marcel's housekeeper until she died. So she was with either both the women or one of the women for 20 years. I worked out she'd be in her early 90s. And then I found her name in the phone book. And I thought, amazing. Lucille Renouf, there she is. I can go to the house. So found in the end that she was in an old people's home and she was 94 and had dementia. But I did get three or four little extraordinary details. And one of the things she said about Claude at the end of her life was that Claude was really mentally ill and had to have everything done for her by Marcel. It was hard for Claude to remain on this earth somehow. She says that herself at some point in her writings. And even her love for Marcel wasn't quite enough. So imagine living with someone like that. You know, that was one of the kind of challenges and extraordinary things about writing the book. It's about loving someone who's kind of impossible. Is your love strong enough to keep them here? Is your love strong enough to make life worthwhile?
It's pretty gripping. You know, what was interesting, too, that you point out in this book is that they decided that she was schizophrenic because they had just put a label on that. So it was,
I think that word was only invented in 1911, right, or something.
What was it that first made you realize you needed to write this love story?
This is the question that writers always get asked, isn't it?
Yeah.
How does the idea...
Because you have to spend so much time,
yeah,
with these people when you begin to write. I mean, does it take you a couple of years to write the novel?
Yeah, a couple of years. I love that Maya Angelou quote. She once said, I think of my body as an ear. And I think writers particularly function in that way. In fact, not just an ear, but a pair of eyes and a nose. And, you know, your senses are always alert for something that might become something. But it's generally not a conscious thing. Ideas occur when you're not expecting them. So with this, it was as simple as, I was living in Barcelona. I had no contact with the literary world in London, and that was a huge relief. It meant I didn't hear when my friends were winning prizes, and I wasn't. So, you know, it's lovely to be isolated. And the only contact with the literary world was I would get this literary magazine called the London Review of Books, which would come every 2 weeks. And I was just leafing through it one day, and suddenly there was this photograph, black and white photograph, and it was one of the photographs I've actually described earlier. Claude Cahun, with a shaved head, black lipstick, a black vest. She looks like a Nosferatu. She looks like something from a vampire movie. Or she looks like something from the club scene in New York in the 80s. It's an extraordinary photograph, and I was amazed when I discovered the photograph had been taken in 1928. And next to the photograph, there was just a little bit of information about her. And I just thought, that is an amazing story. And I kind of knew I wanted to write about her, but it was years before I began. That was 2006.
Oh, wow. So it was in there, percolating.
I like that idea of it sort of gets worked on in the back of your head without you knowing it. And so by the time you start, you have some idea about what you're going to do with it. I didn't really know much of the real story when I started. I started on very little because I wanted to discover what the dynamic was between these two people.
So that means you started writing some of the scenes before,
yeah,
you knew all the details, just to,
yeah,
establish,
yeah,
their character.
I wrote without knowing.
And that's the joy of writing a novel versus writing...
Well, I got to about the seventh draft, and I realized there was very little about these two women in English. Luckily, I can read French, or I couldn't have written this book. And the main biography of Claude is in French by a man called François Lepelier. He actually single-handedly discovered these two women. Pretty much they'd gone missing from history entirely. He discovered them in the 80s. And I went to him, and on the first night together, I had a huge list of questions, but I was going to start the next day. And as I sat with him, having a drink on the first evening, I described the opening scene of my novel, which I was really proud of and which had taken ages to get right. And as I spoke, Monsieur Le Perlier began to slowly shake his head. And when I finished, he went, "Non, impossible." So in a kind of panic, I then described the end of my book, which was also, it turned out, impossible. So I went to bed that night having lost the beginning and end of my book, and the whole thing was falling apart in my hands. So, you know, there's a downside to working intuitively. I kind of saved, actually, both the beginning and the end, because I kind of twisted them around. I did them in a slightly different way, which meant I could get away with them. But it meant I did have a lot of problems later on. But I still don't regret doing it that way, because it's the scenes between and behind the facts that fascinate me. You know, it's the stuff that happens behind closed doors. It's the stuff that's not on the historical record. It's the workings of the psyche, those kind of things that I'm really interested in, and especially with these two women. So the real facts can always come later.
Oh, that's interesting, because the memoir, you had the beginning and the end, and you had problems with the middle, and so with this book, it switched around that way. And they go on to live quite a full life. I mean, it's,
we haven't talked about Paris in the 20s and 30s.
I know.
We haven't talked about the Nazis.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this.
It was extraordinary, because they'd left Paris in 1937, because I think the rise of fascism, the sweeping anti-Semitism across Europe, Paris was becoming very anti-Semitic, and Claude identified as Jewish. Claude's health was very poor, and so they moved to Jersey, which is where they'd always gone on holiday. They'd been going on holiday there for 20 years at that point. And they had real money of their own for the first time, because all their parents had died by then. So they'd inherited enough to buy this extraordinary house on the beach called La Roquette. I think they had the happiest years of their lives there from 1937 to 1940. They may have gone there to escape fascism, but, you know, fascism swept across France so much quicker than anyone was expecting. And the Nazis occupied Jersey in July 1940. And Claude and Marcel had the opportunity to leave, really. Like, half the island left, but the other half remained and decided to make the best of it. And Claude and Marcel were actually determined to fight the Nazis in their own way. So they got away with this amazingly for 4 years, these two little old French ladies, quite eccentric, and I guess that was partly why no one suspected them. But they were finally arrested, and then there began a kind of series of interrogations that are both sinister and hilarious, because, of course, the Nazis can't believe that it's just two old French women who've created this entire network of resistance. So they keep saying, you know, who is the man? Who have you been reporting to? Who is in charge of this network? You know, who trained you? And they keep saying, well, it's just us. You know, and at some point the interrogator says, I find it astonishing that you just got away with it for so long. And one of them says, well, we found it astonishing too. It's a part of the book I really love, because it's sort of terrifying, but it's also hilarious. You know, the two things side by side, almost in a David Lynch kind of way.
What a great story of resistance, too. I want to thank everybody for coming out today.
Rupert Thompson in 2018 at the Kansas City Public Library, talking about his novel, Never Anyone But You, from Penguin Random House. Visit newletters.org for links to this and his memoir, This Party's Got to Stop. There you can also listen to other interviews and sign up for our free podcast. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Dylan Cranhorn, Danny Reeves, Ashley Coate, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.